CFM.
Every week.
It's just 2 weeks from the 50th anniversary of The Prisoner. So get your bookings in Port Merion quickly before they all go.
I assure you, no matter what significance you may hold for me, to the village and its committee, you are merely citizen number 6 who has to be tolerated and, if necessary, shaped to fit.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. My kids will live forever, but your kids will die. The ultimate aim of the transhumanists who see the mind hooking up to the internet. A white bucket fire bomber leaves a bucket on a London tube this morning. But how many Syrian and Yemenis has our taxpayers' money killed this week? And we follow up on last week's 9/11 special by looking at some further aspects of the mother of all false flag attacks, also the Israeli Armed Forces Talpiot program, T-A-L-P-I-O-T. It's for getting their soldiers and spies into key positions of chief executives of high-tech corporations that even our military have to trust and rely on right across the West. And as we trailed a bit earlier, we take a look at transhumanism's links to fascism with the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, David Livingstone. He started by deconstructing myths about Western civilization and ended up identifying high-tech firms such as Google as representing a shop window for ideas of modern fascists. Where a privileged elite are above the law and someday hope to become gods. Our sister show Daleks back on BCFM 93.2, we hope, at noon on Tuesday. This week is that interview with David Livingstone in full, and also another look at Charlottesville and the statues. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or, if you can't wait, or if it doesn't work this week, as it did the last couple of weeks, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, a bomb in Parsons Green this morning. It's been called a bomb, although I heard someone on Five Live describing it as more of a kind of thrump sound. It didn't actually go bang, he said. And there was a lot of fire everywhere at the end of the carriage.
Well, obviously, we're just getting the information about this through.
It's called a fairy light bucket bomb, according to the Telegraph, and it could have killed dozens if it had detonated properly. So what they're saying is that it didn't detonate properly, or as your term you like to use, maybe it was jarked.
Jarking means that a bomb has been interfered with, possibly by security forces or whatever. So if you jark a bomb, you can jark a bomb to go off, jark a bomb not to go off. In other words, the perpetrator plants the bomb but doesn't realise that the bomb's been interfered with by somebody else.
So they may blow themselves up.
You can jark a bomb to blow up the perpetrator.
Could you jark a bomb to do something like this?
Well, it sounds to me a fairly unsophisticated device. That's all I can say. I used to teach in the school right next there, where the girls from Lady Margaret's school have been injured, I understand. I'm sorry to hear that, because I used to teach in that school, and I know the place really well.
Anyway, experts say the bomb was apparently reliant on a string of fairy lights attached to a battery, appeared to have malfunctioned several stations before it was due to explode. The crude device, packed into a builder's white bucket and carried in a little cool bag, exploded on a packed London underground train shortly before 8:30 a.m., injuring 22 people, but thankfully nobody killed.
Well, yes, thankfully nobody killed. I mean, you have to ask yourself the question, the pattern of this. I mean, there is no suicide bomber, clearly. Whoever left the bomb left it and walked off, which of course is a more rational thing to do than committing suicide. But then it doesn't, if you don't tell people you've done it or why you've done it, then there isn't much of a political point to it either. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned in the intro, people in Baghdad, for example, whenever they go out, can expect somebody to bomb them. And that's the way it's been ever since we invaded in 2003.
One thing everybody knows about the London Tube is that all the stations and all the trains are absolutely cameraed up to the maximum, everywhere cameras. Yeah. And yet I'm looking around, still haven't seen any pictures of the person who apparently left it there.
Well,
you would think that that would be absolutely crucial. The first thing the police would do, get pictures of this person and make sure the whole world knew and could identify.
Well, I understand they claim they have a suspect, but they've not released a picture of them. So we will just have to see how this develops. Don't forget that, as you know, on this show we cover frequently the idea that terrorism is not entirely a spontaneous creation. There's usually some hidden hand behind terrorist attacks, often intelligence services, foreign intelligence services, whatever. But this one sounds to me like it could just be a random person doing randomly stupid stuff. But I don't know, and okay, we're just going to have to wait for the investigation.
So the police have identified this suspect, we see from the Metro newspaper, by trawling CCTV. So is there any point in actually not putting out that picture?
Well, if they may not want to warn the person that they know who it is.
The person knows themselves.
Well, I know, but
what's the point in that?
Well, I mean, there is a point in that. I mean, it depends. The police sometimes do not want people to know that they know who they are. But I'm not.
So you could be going for supper with the suspect and not even know it because they haven't.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they've got a picture of somebody planting that bomb on CCTV, then it ought to be fairly straightforward to find out who they are.
To identify them, to make the photograph public, and then get every mind in the country looking at that person saying, I know who that is.
Yeah, it depends. Police sometimes do that and sometimes don't. It's an operational decision for the police. Sometimes they get it wrong. And don't forget, underlying all of this is our suspicion that Western intelligence services are heavily involved in the promotion of Islamist terrorism. They certainly are inside Syria. They certainly have been in the past in other places.
People reported seeing a fireball and a wall of flame in the train and people covered in blood.
Well, I mean, whoever did it, what's the political point of this? And maybe there is no political point. There could be just some of the mental health issues. The creation of a terrorist threat in order to try and steer politics in a direction that the manipulators want it to go, I'm afraid that's very definitely on the agenda. And certainly the attacks during the election campaign and the one previously, the people involved were well known to the security forces, and various elements of the attacks just don't smell right. And we know that NATO intelligence services have an intimate relationship with jihadist terrorists in this country and elsewhere. That's why Britain was seen as a haven for these forces from the 1980s onwards, because MI6 was the lead agency on Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan.
Like Afghanistan, you mentioning there, and Yemen and Syria. Hmm. This is the death. These sorts of deaths are an everyday occurrence. So I see that this week, the United Nations is saying, well, they've been very careful not to make sure there's not a single person who could possibly be involved in the fighting in Yemen is included, but they're now saying that there's 5,000 people, all civilians, definitely civilians, have died, an absolute minimum.
Indeed, and of course we hear virtually nothing about it on our TV, even though we've been bombarded for years with how evil the Syrian government is. They're bombing their own people. How awful.
The
Saudis have invaded Yemen with our support and are killing loads of civilians, and we hardly hear anything about it because we're implicated. We're implicated in killing people in Syria as well. Planting bombs on the London Tube.
Yeah, Jeremy
Certainly
Corbyn
doesn't.
Is suggesting that there's some kind of blowback involved in these attacks.
Well, there may or may not be. The point is, we got to find out the facts about what this particular incident represents.
What exactly are we doing in Yemen? Because our military is involved, isn't it? The RAF particularly.
Yeah, well, there's British military personnel based in Saudi Arabia helping the Saudis with their war effort.
That's definitely the case. We're targeting civilians.
Yep, definitely. I mean, what's
the point of this war?
Well, the Saudis aspire to being hegemonic in their part of the world. They want everybody dancing to their tune. The Saudis are our allies, and we work with them to frustrate the Syrian government, for example. So the Saudis have provided the money, the SAS provided the training, and the Saudis also recruited lots of people from across the Middle East, including from their own prisons, to fight inside Syria. I've mentioned this before on the show, but it's worth mentioning again. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, when interviewed on French TV some years ago, said he was approached by British officials who said, "We're going to run an armed uprising in Syria." So we're implicated both in the armed struggle in Syria and in what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. British military personnel are involved. I'm not a pacifist. Those people are running a big risk of somebody deciding that they ought to die. Perhaps they should die.
We were talking about Nazis within the British Army, or at least neo-Nazis, and two British soldiers have been charged now with terror offences and being members of a neo-Nazi right-wing group. The soldiers were arrested the week before last in the UK, where a fourth was held by the Royal Military Police in Cyprus. This is in the Daily Mirror. Two British soldiers charged with terror offences, alleged membership of the banned neo-Nazi far-right group called National Action. It's been described as anti-Semitic and homophobic, but now we actually have charges.
Well, we'll have to see when it comes to court what we're actually looking at here. Don't forget, in Operation Gladio in the past, the intelligence services are encouraging all sorts of different kinds of terrorists so that they can then either let them carry out their terrorist attack and therefore frighten the population, or alternatively capture them and put them on trial and demonstrate how efficient they are at capturing people. That's clearly what's been going on with the FBI in the United States. 95% of the people sentenced to prison in the United States for terrorism offences are completely entrapped by the FBI.
Well, this illegal
the
group,
other 5%
this illegal group
dead.
National Action apparently has around about 100 members.
Yeah.
West Midlands Counter-Terrorism Unit and Welsh Extremism Counter-Terrorism Unit Wales Extremism Counterterrorism Unit carried out the arrests with East Midlands Counterterrorism Unit. Gosh, lots of counterterrorism units there all getting together. And Alexander Deakin, 22 years age, from Birmingham, and Mikko Verelium. I'll put a link up to this on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, in Brecon at the army camp, and also Mark Barrett, 24. He's been charged with membership of this group. They said he'd been also charged, Deakin particularly, been charged with possessing documents useful in committing or preparing an act of terrorism, distributing a terrorist publication, and inciting racial hatred.
Well, the least you could say is that if you're going to be a member of the British Army, you shouldn't be a part of these organisations. And the same would go for police officers. And, you know, it's necessary for these people to be rooted out. I mean, as you know, that not that long ago, a German soldier was captured and put on trial, or was going to be put on trial, for creating a false identity as a Syrian refugee, under which false identity he was going to carry out a terrorist attack in Vienna airport, which would be blamed on Syrian refugees. That chap is now in custody and he's going to go on trial in Germany. But one has to wonder what the level of manipulation is here. We know in the past that NATO intelligence services have created terrorist incidents in order to try and steer the population in certain directions. I'm not saying that's what's happened here, but I mean, obviously the National Action has been infiltrated by the state. That's how they've managed to identify these people.
Okay.
The question is the state manipulating National Action?
Interesting, another story this week, and it'd be nice to hear whether you think this is fake news or not. And this is on the Press TV, the Iranian channel. The United States airlifts ISIS-Daesh terrorists in Syria for the second time in a week. For the second time this week, a helicopter operating under the US-led coalition has transferred members of the Daesh terrorist group in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province, a UK-based monitoring group is saying. Now, Martin, what do you think about this? Is this fake news?
Well, it's coming from...
It's pretty explosive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming from...
effectively rescued the top ISIS commanders.
It's coming, as I understand, from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry here. It's a single guy based in Coventry. And they've been regarded in the past as very much propaganda by the West. So if they're saying this, it's quite interesting. But I also understand that the Russian military have said that they want answers from the Americans about this. And they're saying that, you know, the US military has denied that they've done this. But the Russians have said, well, we want to hear something from Trump about this, because we don't necessarily accept that he knows what's going on here. And, of course, the point that's been made all along by the Syrians, the Iranians and the Russians is that ISIS has been receiving support from Western intelligence services. That's what the Iraqi government believe as well.
Well, talking of Trump...
That's just what they believe.
Talking of
what
Trump...
What people choose to
Martin,
believe and listen to this is up to them.
There's been a bit of a Twitter spat between Donald Trump and the Metropolitan Police today.
Yes.
Trump assuming that this is an Islamist attack on London, and the Met saying quite politely, we don't know who the suspects are, so it's a bit... difficult to say.
Maybe Trump knows more than we do, because if CIA, for example, were trying to taste us up and get us all frightened of Islamists, they may know more about this attack than
but
we do.
Bizarre, just isn't as, it? Just as in the Metro, Martin, they're saying they do know who this. They do have a suspect.
Yes, but they don't know what the suspect's politics are. They don't even know whether they're a Muslim or whatever. They've got a suspect.
They've got a face, that's all.
That's all. And, of course, Trump is just presuming it's clearly a Muslim, blah, 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 like he does.
Let me just say to the Metropolitan Police, put that face out there. We need to know. If we're walking down the street and we see this person, whoever it is, that's put this fairy light bomb, whatever it is, on the London Tube, surely people have a right to know. What possible reason is there not to share that?
It's an operational decision for the police whether they put a suspect's face out or not. Sometimes they get it wrong, but there's legitimate reasons why they might not want
it's only a suspect, surely. The main thing is...
No, they may already know where he is. And they may even know exactly... They may be preparing
to
arrest him.
They may be sort of hiding around the corner if
they've already identified the person, then putting their face out gives them a warning that they're going to be arrested. If they've already identified them and they're preparing to arrest them, they don't want to put their face out there because then they'll know they're going to be arrested, won't they? I'm just presuming. I don't know. I'm not privy to the police's thinking about this. But there are legitimate reasons why they wouldn't put the face out there.
Okay. Any other thoughts about international stories for this week?
Well, international stories from this week. What can I think of? I read a lot all the time, and I'm just trying to think what's. I mean, obviously, there's the ongoing North Korea business and the latest missile. Flying over Japan and all the rest of it, the potential for that to just slide out of control is obviously there. There's moves to the BRICS meeting in China, as they're talking about trying to create an alternative currency system for the world. The Venezuelans have stopped accepting dollars for their oil, which may be a straw in the wind. And, you know, the potential for things to run out of control is very much still
okay,
with
let's
us.
Let's talk about North Korea anyway, briefly. Yes, apparently it could get as far as Japan. It went a bit further than Japan. Should we be really worried? I mean, we hear this wall to wall on the mainstream press, North Korea
well,
all the time.
The fact is that the rhetoric by the Americans of threatening to attack North Korea, I mean, it's not, and the extra sanctions that were agreed in the UN Security Council with the Russians and the Chinese, the obvious response to that by Pyongyang is just to carry on throwing their rattle out of the pram, quite literally, because they haven't got anything else to do. I mean, threatening them isn't going to make them stop doing what they're doing, quite clearly not. In fact, the more you shout at them, the more likely they are to do this stuff. The only thing that's going to stop them doing it is if there's some comprehensive agreement to stop threatening to invade them. And since every 2 years, the Western powers and the South Koreans have a massive exercise where they pretend to invade North Korea. It's not surprising that the North Koreans presume that they're going to be invaded, especially when they look at what's happened in Iraq and Libya and elsewhere. So it's very difficult to see how they're going to be made to behave themselves. What threats are you going to make to them, which are going to make them stop doing what they're doing?
Here's a question.
They're not going to take any notice.
Here's a question for you: which is the most corrupt country in the world?
Well, according to who? Transparency International?
Well, Brazil, the Brazilian president is facing racketeering obstruction of justice charges. That's after they got rid of Dilma Rousseff. Yeah. This is Michael Turner has been accused of racketeering and obstruction of justice. He acted as a leader, apparently, of a criminal organisation, according to a statement posted by the chief prosecutor, Rodrigo Janot, on Thursday. That's yesterday. The prosecutor stated his gang, made up of senior members of the party, all allegedly taken $190 million in bribes in return for contracts at public companies.
Well, so he's
new president they have in Brazil is just as corrupt.
Rousseff, who's been removed through judicial coup, even their enemies accept that she's not actually personally corrupt, and the evidence against her and against Lula is largely fabricated, in my view.
So is this actually a sort of self-harming by the judiciary?
What it is virtually all the non-PT politicians in Brazil are totally corrupt. PT has got some corruption involved with it, but less than the others. They've been the situation in Brazil is rather unfortunate, because Brazil is a very big country, potentially a swing country, part of the BRICS group, and I'm afraid both Brazil and South Africa are being destabilised by Western powers because they want to mess up the potential for the BRICS to, you know, develop alternative currency arrangements and so on. And there's going to be more and more of this as we go forward. And the potential for this to lead to a crash is always there if there's misjudgments. And, you know, if you start dashing sanctions around on everybody, let's just presume, for example, that the sanctions on Russia had worked and the Russian economy had been pushed into the down the drain. Well, that would have pulled down all the rest of the world's economy with it, because they're a big economy, and if they go down, we go down.
Well,
with
we
them.
Talked about 9/11 last week in Afghanistan, and a few weeks ago there was an announcement that 4,000 US troops were going to bolster their presence in Afghanistan. This week it's quietly crept up to 6,000 troops. What is going on? Why are these extra troops needed in Afghanistan? Could this be an indication of something else going on?
Well, it's essentially Trump was talking about getting out of Afghanistan. The generals are now in charge of the policy, and he's been forced to change his policy and to send more troops to Afghanistan. The fact is, they used to have up to 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. They're still unable to defeat the insurgency, and 4,000 extra US troops in Afghanistan is not going to make any material difference. The purpose of the US being in Afghanistan is to keep the Chinese out, to prevent the Chinese getting access to the raw materials. There's quite a lot of raw materials.
So the Chinese would go in there?
If the situation stabilised and became peaceful, the Afghanistan...
Doesn't this imply the Americans intend to ramp things up?
Yes, they do. Because the Chinese One Belt, One New Silk Road project is that they want to try and build infrastructure across Eurasia, which will allow all of these countries to develop. And they're going to put in state-of-the-art trains, pipelines and stuff like this. Now, that very much relies upon peace. So if these wars are settled in this arc of conflict across Central Asia, then the Chinese project can go ahead. And the obvious way for the Americans to prevent that going ahead is to make sure that these wars just drag on and that there's no development, and that the Chinese proposals to develop the region on a peaceful basis are constantly thwarted.
I think
the Indian government are taking a pretty obstructive relationship to the Chinese at the moment. And this is all because the Americans have encouraged them to do so. And
let's just take a look at South Korea for a minute, because you've got a feel for these people. They're kind of caught in the middle, really, aren't they? A very prosperous country, very good education system there. But the South Korean leader, Moon Jae-in, seems like a man who can't stop saying yes, even though he was elected, effectively, to slow down US influence. The opposite is happening.
Yes, and of course...
And demonstrations on the streets, tens of thousands of people on the streets.
That's right.
We're seeing very little about that on the news.
Well, I mean, in the run-up to the election, he said he was going to get rid of the THAAD missile system, which the Americans have put into South Korea, and that's because that missile system can do nothing whatsoever to protect South Korea. If the North Koreans decide to nuke South Korea or even attack South Korea conventionally, that missile system is worthless. Its only real purpose is to put pressure on China and Russia, because that missile system is a first strike system, or it can knock down a retaliatory strike. And the withdrawal from the ABM treaty by the US after 9/11 and so on, has led to a destabilisation of nuclear geopolitics, and this is very dangerous. But no, they're no longer relying on mutually assured destruction. They're talking in terms of they can use nuclear weapons to win a war. And there are people openly saying in the US that we should nuke North Korea.
This whole argument applies to Europe too, doesn't it? Because the Germans are actually now saying, several of the senior German politicians fighting this election are now saying, right, well, vote for us and we'll get rid of all the US nukes from Germany.
Yes, but at the same time...
But
at the same time, the Poles and the Romanians are happy to have, or their leaders are happy to have, these anti-missile missiles on their territory, which of course is much more threatening to the Russians than, you know, essentially retaliatory stuff based in Germany. But, I mean, the whole point is that the nuclear war fighting is now being openly discussed in a way that it hasn't been for a generation.
The other side to this, of course, is the effective break-ins in the embassies over in California by the Americans of the Russians. Now, the Russians are just saying, well, we can't quite believe you're doing this.
Well, that's right, and they've also said that RT will have to register Russia Today, for which I do regular things, is going to be made to register as a foreign agent, and they're going to, they're going to be put under surveillance, etc. Tension is being ratcheted up here. That's no doubt about that, and I don't think anybody wants an all-out nuclear war, but you could end up with one just because people are basically shooting their mouths off. And words are weapons, and it might be better for everybody just calm down a bit and talk in a calmer tone of voice, and we might be able to resolve some.
Surely at the back of this, there is actually a wish to escalate things from the Pentagon.
There is, yes, and
what? So why?
Well, because basically it's a boondoggle. These generals who run the Pentagon, when they retire, they go onto the boards of the companies that supply the stuff to the Pentagon. The US taxpayer pays for it all, and it keeps everybody in private school fees and all the rest of it. And that's what's underlying all of this. And there's an unwillingness to compromise with the Russians and the Chinese to develop a world order that works for everybody. That's obviously what's going to happen in the end, one way or another, if we survive. But there's definitely a group based in the US of oligarchs who do not want to accept changes in the world order, which means that they will have to compromise with others. They're not used to compromising. They don't like the idea of it, and they're determined that they're going to prevent it.
So has Kim Jong-un outmaneuvered the Americans this time, do you think?
Well, he's basically got his back against the wall. I mean, they basically said, we want a regime change you. Now, at that point, he's under no pressure whatsoever to give up his nuclear weapons, because if he does, then he's going to be regime change. He's going to end up with a bane upon his bone like Gaddafi.
Deterrence, isn't it, I think?
Well, that's the reason why we've got them. Perhaps I'll tell you what we could do. We could flog him our Trident missile system, use the money to pay for schools and hospitals, because we don't need it and he does, and it's a free market. Why don't we do that?
Not sure about that, Martin.
That wasn't one of my better ideas.
Let's do a bit of a follow up anyway on our discussion last week with Ian Henshaw on the some of the details of the September the 11th attacks. One of the things we didn't really talk that much about was the way that it's affected things today in terms of policy, particularly with what you would call Islamophobia, even though, of course, if you go back to September the 11th and start looking at that, it doesn't look as if this is some kind of bin Laden operation at all.
Well, I mean, obviously we covered this very extensively last week. The purpose of this is to demonise Muslims, to demonise Al-Qaeda as the culprits, and therefore to justify intervention willy-nilly in any country that the US deems to be an enemy. And, you don't have to be a genius to work out what the motivation is here or what we've ended up with. And all these years later, we're still on this disastrous road to nowhere.
Where do you think we are heading, though? Because surely there's more and more pushback and resistance around the world saying, well, actually, that we don't really want to go along with this
plan.
Well,
one of the problems with a failing hegemon like the US, so they've been had a dominant.
Can you compare this to the fall of Rome? I mean, you know, or the.
Well, you can compare it to anything like that. I mean, all empires rise and fall. They reach their kind of, you know, their peak point, and then
the Roman emperor started, you know, coming up with crazy ideas, doing all sorts of nutty stuff.
Yeah.
And eventually the whole thing just collapsed, didn't
it? Well, yes, but I mean, the classic analysis of this is by Paul Kennedy, US academic, and it's imperial overstretch. Eventually all empires grow so big that they can't in fact contain, you know, the resources, and they haven't got the resources to I mean, you know, this is the US empire is effectively the biggest ever. I mean, they want full spectrum dominance, they want to control the whole planet, and even the Japanese and German militarists in World War II didn't think they were going to control the whole planet, they just wanted to control their bits of it. The US power elite aspires to control the whole planet, and because they've got such big aspirations, that's why they keep doubling down, even when the logical thing to do would be to draw in their horns and get a bit more moderate, be a bit like the Emperor Hadrian, who decided he was interested in art and culture and architecture, and he built Hadrian's Wall. He built a similar wall in Libya, and he's basically saying, well, the Roman Empire is as big as we want it to be. We don't really want to invade Scotland because there's nothing there. Even if we got there, what would we get out of it? Nothing. So we're just going to build this wall here, and we're going to live behind the wall. And the Scots from the on the other side, well, weren't the Scots in those days picked?
But there's
on the
are there
side
any,
of the wall. They can,
are
they can,
there any Hadrians around in the US?
Well, no, there aren't. This is the problem. The aspiration is to control everything. It's a bit megalomaniac. You know, the US is in fact a relatively small country compared to the rest of the world. It's a tiny percentage of the world's population, even though they've got an awful lot of the resources and the wealth because of the power that they have in controlling the world's reserve currency and so on. But I think they've been driven slightly mad by their own power, so that instead of rationally assessing what it is they can and can't do and where they want to go in cooperation with others, there's a continuous attempt to try and basically get the all or nothing. So for example, when Trump was in India the other week with Modi, who's the Prime Minister of India, and they'd done a big deal to buy loads of weaponry from the Americans, and Trump was joking that by the time the weapons were delivered, they'd be demanding more money for the weaponry than they'd already paid. So he was joking with Modi that you've already agreed to buy this weaponry off us for price X, but we're actually going to make you pay price Y because we're America first.
Is that sounds a bit like HS2?
Well, indeed, it's just, well, what it is all of this money being spent is cash registers going ka-ching for certain individuals and groups who are making
it
money.
It does seem like, almost like a religion, this money nowadays. Also, Donald Trump, Martin, in the run-up to the election campaign, was saying, you may find the Saudis were behind the 9/11 attacks.
Well, he's gone quiet on that, hasn't he, after he went to visit them and was prancing around waving swords with them all. I don't think you can take anything Donald Trump says too seriously, although he did point out, for example, that the buildings couldn't have collapsed through fires on 9/11. There's a quote, people will perhaps put a link to his quote on the show page, where he was saying, well, I build these buildings for a living, and I went round the World Trade Center in 1993 after the bombings there, which were actually carried out by FBI informants, and he said the building didn't come down even though there were bombs in the basement.
Is there any real terrorism out there, or is this all
I think there are
done by the state?
There are angry
the state or private bodies outside the state.
There's more than one thing going on, but a lot of so-called radical Islamist terrorism of the Sunni Salafi variety, very definitely run by the Gulf Cooperation Council secret services and our own secret services. And that doesn't mean that there aren't individuals with ill intent. There are, but they're not really that dangerous. They get dangerous when they've got resources and backup.
I know I had a fascinating conversation earlier this week with David Livingston over in the US about transhumanism, and he was quite clear that these people are in power, they've got a lot of power, they've got fantastic amounts of money, and I asked him about the sort of personality behind these people, because with the idea of transhumanism effectively being to when people can become gods, that's what he says, but the idea is that you as an individual, as humans, can create a kind of artificial intelligence that then goes on with a life of its own. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about the psychology behind people behind and involved in this transhumanist movement.
What they believe is that people are stupid. They believe that they are privileged. They believe that they believe that the basis of their privilege is that they have the mental fortitude to of a Nietzschean kind of interpretation. They believe that that people, because people are mentally weak, even spiritually weak, they need to invent phantoms like gods, a god or a religion. And to them, they believe that a person with true character is able to acknowledge that there is no truth and face the abyss. So this is basically what Nietzsche talked about. What typically happens there is, and I write about this in my book Transhumanism, because the scream, the painting, the scream is supposed to be a representation or portrayal of that realization. So the first realization is panic, is the scream, is the horror. But for these guys, it's getting beyond that initial fear, and they think that they have the strength to be able to just accept that there is no right and wrong, that there is no purpose to our existence. So you can basically do whatever you want.
Well, but hang on, but even children know the difference between right and wrong. I mean, if 3, 4, 5 year old.
Absolutely, they're arrogant. This is the nature of evil. They are choosing to reject right and wrong to justify their own actions, but they just build it up in an elaborate philosophy to make it seem like it's well thought out.
Well, I think the mention of Nietzsche there is interesting, of course, because he was the famous 19th century philosopher who said God is dead. He was the idea of the Superman, human beings or certain group of human beings were going to be the leaders of the future, and they were going to determine what should happen, etc.
I mean, surely human beings have always been leaders. What's different about Nietzsche?
Well, I mean, Nietzsche is influential in philosophical circles, even by those who don't agree with him, because he pushed to the limit these kind of ideas. Although I think that in actual fact there's an awful lot of gobbledygook in Nietzsche as well. It's not actually that logical. It's literary rather than philosophical in some respects.
Can you just in a nutshell, what did he say?
Well, he basically most famously said God is dead. In other words, what he was saying is that, and he was right about this, is that what would increasingly happen as the 19th century went into the 20th century is that traditional ways of thinking about the world would gradually be eroded away, and that people would no longer believe in God as the old chap in the crowds.
He was right, wasn't he?
Well, he was right, yes, and that's why he was influential, because he was pointing in a direction of something that society was evolving in that sort of direction.
But having said that, I mean, there's probably lots of reasons why there's less faith around now than there was, and that's partly because it's in those days. I mean, for example, if you didn't go to church on a Sunday, you would have your collar felt. I mean, you had to go if you go back to medieval times, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. And of course gradually some societies more than others. I mean, Britain is a relative
Britain is one
of the most secular societies in the world. I mean, of course, plenty of religious people in Britain even now, but a majority of young people now say that they have no religious belief.
Well, this theory of evolution has been very, very powerful too.
That's
even though, of course, it's a theory, it's treated by many, including in many schools, as fact.
Well, look, that's another topic, to be honest with you. I mean, if we're talking about what you have got in the US in particular, if you think of Leo Strauss and the neocons, Leo Strauss was very influential, Ayn Rand even more influential. They are basically philosophers of selfishness. Both Leo Strauss and Ayn Rand said there's an elite that really knows what it's doing and we are that elite. The masses are just idiots and they're there to be manipulated. They're to be told one thing. That, in other words, Leo Strauss was all in favour of religious beliefs for the masses, but not for the leaders. And essentially, these are, you know, fascist ideas. And somebody like Ayn Rand, for example, has been enormously influential. Virtually all US politicians claim that they love her and found her books incredibly revealing, and she's the most important philosopher ever. And basically, she's a journalist turned novelist of very limited intellectual capacity who's now dead. And her basic philosophy was, look after number one, and that's what you should do, and all these other ideas from Confucius, Jesus, Buddha, Karl Marx, all a load of rubbish. Look after number one, that's my philosophy. And of course, even if it is your philosophy, you shouldn't tell people. Genghis Khan used to tell them that he was fulfilling God's will, because that's what you tell people. But it's a bit silly, these people, because they talk openly amongst themselves about their own elite ideas of them not manipulating the masses, and you thought, well, actually, you've just told us what your game is, so that's not really that bright, is it?
So is this just about kind of dressing up selfishness?
Yes.
Wickedness?
Yes.
Stealing other people's property?
Yes.
Bullying, subjugating people with some kind of sugar-coated pill?
Yes, it is, and of course it's also geared towards a particular audience, the people who love Ayn Rand, Greenspan, who ended up as head of the Federal Reserve, who used to be a great friend of hers and so on, is that they are the elite. And they, because they are the elite, they like the idea that the elite should run things and that the masses are stupid and need to be manipulated. And that's very attractive to elite people. But that's got an awful lot to do with their social position. As Karl Marx pointed out many years ago, social being determines consciousness. If you are the elite, then you believe that the elite should be in charge, and that's all good. But of course, if you're not part of the elite, that doesn't really add up, does it?
Yeah, a bit worrying that this can sort of crystallise out into some kind of positive philosophy, which is taken seriously by mainstream
press.
What's
extraordinary to me is that this is taken seriously by intelligent people. Ayn Rand is not a philosopher, but she's presented by many wealthy Americans, inside the political structure and in business, as some kind of guru. And in actual fact, this is drivel. It's low-level stuff, but they actually think that it's profound. And that's really worrying.
What's also worrying is the way that the mainstream media often treats it as profound.
Well, the point is, she's become a very influential person, as has Leo Strauss, as well, in influencing the neoconservative movement.
I mean, is it true what David Livingstone
Strauss
was saying
has got,
there?
Strauss has got more intellectual credibility than Rand. They're both dead and they're both wrong.
Is it true that what David Livingstone is saying there, that they that people are stupid enough maybe to believe this stuff? I mean, that's what their arrogance in a way comes from, this whole thing of saying, well, people are stupid, we can manipulate them, look at us.
Well, I mean, people can be manipulated, we know that, but I think that they are deluded if they feel that they can control the processes that are setting in motion. It's the whole, like we were talking earlier about the geopolitical situation. I don't think anybody in the Pentagon wants a nuclear war in a Dr. Strangelove way. What they want is a society based around war, with everybody totally terrified, and essentially a police state that people accept because they're frightened of the consequences of letting go of it, and lots of money being spent on the things they want it spent on, which keeps them happy. But of course, the problem with warfare is it's not something that can be planned like that. Nobody wanted World War One. Nobody on any side was looking for a war, but it happened anyway because of everybody's stupid attitudes and unwillingness to think outside the box.
And no doubt it can happen again.
Indeed.
I'm sure there are some people out there thinking, what on earth has this got to do with anything in the real world? And one of the next questions I asked to David Livingstone was about this precise, I mean, how can we pin this down? And he was saying that actually that the transhumanists have strong links to the intelligence services and also to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, that the whole Salafist ideology, which is supposed to be part of Islam, was actually dreamt up by an English spy.
I got inspired by the program that I took, the college course that I took, and basically it was, they were, everything was coordinated into 3 years. And so the first year was from the Bible to the French Revolution, and then French Revolution to the 20th century, and then 20th century. So kind of followed that. So when I wrote The Dying God, it's basically from the earliest times to pretty much the French Revolution, and it follows the history of the occult from Babylon, from to Greece, and then Islam is an important factor as well. Islam also got affected or infected with the occult, producing the mystical tradition of Sufism. Then I explore the occult bases of the Renaissance, and then the development of secret societies like the Freemasons, Illuminati, Rosicrucians, which ultimately led to the French Revolution. And then after that, my second book is called Terrorism and the Illuminati, and there I explore in the main organization that is being used to carry out acts of terrorism in the name of Islam is an organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is an organization which basically is ultimately an occult organization, a Masonic organization. So I explore amazingly intertwined with some of the most important elements of the Western occult tradition, particularly they follow the Salafi tradition, which was founded by a guy named a Mason named Jamaluddin Afghani, who was an English agent, who was also happened to be one of the important teachers, according to K. Paul Johnson, of H.P. Blavatsky.
She was the founder of Theosophy. Yeah, a very important organization. Yeah, in fact, we've got just next to the BBC here in Bristol, we've got the Bristol Theosophists blazoned across one of the big buildings there.
Right. It's hugely important. I mean, she's really pretty much the godmother of modern occultism. She's considered the godmother of the New Age movement as well. So after that, I wrote Black Terror, White Soldiers. There's the aspect of the occult tradition which has really been missed by, I think, almost every scholar is what's called synarchism. And this really develops with René Guénon, who temporarily was a member of the Theosophical Society as well, too. But he's the one who developed this stream called traditionalism. And his most important student was Julius Evola. And Julius Evola is pretty much the godfather late 20th century fascism, occult fascism, and behind what's called Operation Gladio. And after that, I did transhumanism. And then my latest book kind of goes back to the Black Terror, White Soldiers book, which again explores the history of traditionalism to follow the history of late 20th century fascism, particularly its development in the United States with the Patriot Movement, with the basically far-right conservative movement in the United States, which ultimately created the movement behind that had Donald Trump elected.
Well, there's an awful lot in there. And you know, there's...
Cynicism, what about them?
What did you say?
Cynarchism.
Well, I've never heard of synarchism until he just mentioned it. So, as I say, there's an awful lot in there.
But one of the things, I mean, this is a theme that comes up on this program quite a lot, is this whole theme he's addressing in this book, Black Terror, White Soldiers, where the idea is that actually there's a whole... that happens to be white people behind this whole idea of the black terrorist outrage.
Well, look, I mean, taking it down to a more basic level... The state engages in manipulations of the population. He mentioned Gladio there. That's absolutely historical. People can carry out a search and they can find what Gladio was. They won't find everything about it because we still don't know everything about it. And I'm quite sure that there are some occult elements in all of this. We know, for example, that the Nazis had strong occult leanings. People like Himmler sent expeditions to Tibet to look for the Holy Grail and this sort of thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everything is connected to everything else in some kind of conspiratorial way. What you've got is powerful groups using their power in order to try and extend their power. And it's been going on for a very long time. It's been going on in medieval history, modern history, and right up to date.
What about the Muslim Brotherhood, for example?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, it's interesting you should mention the Muslim Brotherhood, because in actual fact, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudis are not on the same page at all, which is one of the reasons why the Qataris and the Saudis have fallen out, and why Sisi is aligned with Saudi Arabia rather than with Qatar, is because the Muslim Brotherhood are regarded by the Saudis as a threat. The Saudi ruling class is essentially a corrupt Salafist elite based on Wahhabi links, which the British encouraged. So the British encouraged the creation of the Saudi state based on Salafi Wahhabi ideas, and those Salafi Wahhabi ideas are neither Sufi ideas. They're very hostile to Sufism. So it's funny you've mentioned Sufism there. Sufism is a much more diffuse and interesting than Salafism, frankly. But the Muslim Brotherhood are Salafi as well, but they are hostile to the Saudis, and the Saudis are hostile to them because the Saudis don't want mass movements of any kind.
Okay, they're elitist. Getting to the nub of some of what David was saying, he talks about the Pinay Circle and also mimetic warfare, the idea of using memes and the Discordians. So let's have a listen to that final clip now.
We don't need to name them the Illuminati in our time, but there's enough evidence. In fact, it seems like one of the more powerful groups in our time has been Le Cercle, or the Cercle Pinay, and that's really the founded by a couple of Bilderbergers, and has really been the parent organization behind much of the fascist international. I mean, a well-known anarcho-capitalist would be Murray Rothbard, and he's really one of the godfathers of the modern libertarian movement. What's interesting there is that he developed with his partner Lou Rockwell, who used to write for Ron Paul, by the way, they developed what they call an outreach to rednecks strategy, which was basically to appeal to racist sentiments in the U.S. as a Trojan horse to carry forward their neoliberal ideology, or what they call anarcho-capitalist. These groups and thinkers are very closely aligned to the leading transhumanists, particularly a person like Robert Anton Wilson, who's very much the godfather of, in some ways, the godfather of transhumanism, particularly for his role in the popularization of a very strange tradition called Discordianism. So my latest book, really, it kind of wraps up all these trends that I've been following. You have the very close relationship between fascism, transhumanism, and Discordianism. And so Discordianism is what it sounds like. It's a belief that life is chaos. It devolves out of chaos in the belief in chaos magic. And chaos magic is really the modern form of occultism today. We've really seen it play out in the election of Donald Trump, with the creation of fake news popularized by various online communities, particularly 4chan, which is basically populated by Discordians. And so it's what they call mimetic warfare. It's based on their agenda of rocking the boat, of deliberately confronting what they call political correctness by being deliberately offensive, by inciting hatreds and prejudices, is all part of what is basically their form of magic, and which is basically is chaos magic, which is ultimately tied to esoteric fascism. And that's the times that we're heading in these days.
That's David Livingstone there, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. A final clip from him. Martin, he's actually talking about the origins also there, and the strength of this group, Le Cercle, which we've studied a few times on this programme. We've mentioned them anyway, which is a sort of coordinating body, it seems. And people like the far-right MP Jonathan Aitken was chairman of that for a while. And I wonder what you make of that final contribution he made there. So a lot of it is about what he's calling mimetic warfare, which effectively what we talk about, I suppose, on this show is psychological warfare.
Yeah, you could call it fourth generation warfare. What I find interesting, I mean, that's the first I've ever heard of this guy or his clips, is that he's got a lot of interesting stuff there, but he's mixing stuff up. I mean, Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell are libertarians. I don't agree with them. Murray Rothbard's dead, but I mean, but Murray Rothbard, in fact, is a libertarian with a very hostile view of the state and the state's role in warfare. how he can be lumped in with people like Leo Strauss, who are neoconservative warmongers.
Well, I don't think he quite did that. But what I think he's saying is that they're trying to divide society up into lots of different types of people and then control each group.
Well, that's right. And that's certainly, if you think about, you know, coming back to down to earth with Gladio, the intelligence services were manipulating all sorts of left-field groups, right-field groups, mainstream politicians were also being manipulated. You know, that's what they want to do. They want to fragment society so that they can divide and rule. But you can't just lump all these different things in together. These different people have got different ideas. And I'd have to read his books to see what he's saying.
Maybe you could do that. But I think what he's saying is that it's controlled centrally, that people who appear to have opposing views are controlled centrally. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook. Hopefully, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith, and to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like from at thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Is wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from the 1990s, completely unknown artist. Maybe you can help. Let me know. Leave a comment on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. Please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.